The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Larry Kirsten. It's my great honor to introduce our guest this evening, Maggie Haberman. She was a part of a team that won a 2018 Pulitzer Prize for its reporting of the investigations into the then President Donald Trump's and his advisors' connections to Russia. She has also twice been part of a Pulitzer Prize finalist team in 2021 for reporting on the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic, and in 2022 for reporting on the January 6th riot at the Capitol. Currently a New York Times reporter, Ms. Haberman is a former political reporter for Politico, New York Post, and New York Daily News, and she became a CNN political analyst in 2014. Her number one best-selling book, Confidence Man, she uses hundreds of sources in interviews, including many with Trump himself, to offer a definitive account of the previous president's chaotic campaigns, tumultuous term in office, and tortured post-presidency. On a personal note, Ms. Haberman is the daughter-in-law of one of my great heroes, the late Vartan Gregorian, who knew a thing about libraries. Tonight, Ms. Haberman will be in conversation with Tamala Edwards, anchor for 6 ABC Action News Morning Edition. Please join me in welcoming Maggie Haberman and Tamala Edwards to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Welcome and good evening. Thank you for coming out tonight. You know how much I love being here with you. And boy, Maggie, have I been looking forward to being here with you. Now, I'm going to do something a little different than what I usually do. Usually, I kind of have my questions in my head and just keep going. You'll notice me following questions more because, as I've told Maggie, I actually want to read some sections of her book. And I know a lot of you are going to talk about the news and what's going on right now, but there's so much great in this book. I want to be sure that we get to it. I wish we had 5 hours. I will try to be good and end when my time is over because I know you have a million questions, but let's get going. Maggie, thank you for being here. First of all, I want to talk about the title of the book, and I looked it up on the internet today.
Ooh.
Confidence Man, which is something you don't hear a lot in modern terms, and the internet say the definition is old-fashioned term for con man. Now, if you've seen Maggie on air and other places, you know she's very circumspect, very laid back. And I was like, here's Maggie showing a little leg. Yeah, obviously, you had to think a lot about this title. Why did you pick this one?
It's a great question. First of all, thank you for having me. Thank you for being here. And thank you all for being here. I'm really excited. I mentioned to some of you earlier, we have a lot of Philly connections in our family, so it's really great to be here. I chose the title first off after my husband gave me the okay, he is who I listen to on lots of things. It's obviously got two meanings, right? I mean, so one is about confidence, and Donald Trump is big on exuding confidence and trying to, you know, show a certain level of, of behavior and of strength and so forth. But a confidence man, as your internet research revealed, is defined as somebody who uses, you know, persuasive tactics to take things from someone else. And I think that history has shown that over a very long period of time, through his business career and through the presidency, Donald Trump did that.
You know, a lot of books have talked about the administration and what we saw in those days. And the latter half of your book gets into that. But you go to a place that a lot of books don't go, which is a lot of people wanted to say, where did he come from? And you said, well, I will tell you where he came from. And I want to show you something, a photo that's on the front of the book and the back of the book. So on the front of the book, you see a picture of a young Donald Trump, and it's almost a mirror image of the same man 50 years later. And this is a theme of the book, that who he is who he has always been. And it's almost, what was interesting to me is that it felt as though he was suspended in amber, which most of us over our lives, the whole point is, if I met you, there'd be elements of who you were if I knew you at 16, 35, 47, 52. He's who he's always been. And I want to read something that you wrote on page 10. For all the intrigue that is part of the Trump mythos, the talk of his unpredictability or descriptions of him as an agent of chaos, the irony, say those who have known him for years, is that he's had only a handful of moves throughout his entire adult life. There's the counterattack, there's the quick lie, there's the shift of blame, there's the distraction or misdirection, there's the outburst of rage, there's the performative anger, there's the design just for the headlines action or claim, there's the indecisiveness masked by a compensatory lunge, there's the backbiting about another advisor with another advisor creating a wedge between them. The challenge is figuring out at any given moment what trick he is using. It was always there in front of us.
It was. And it was funny when you just talked about suspended in amber. I literally used to say throughout 2016 that he is, and frankly in 2011 when he was considering running, that he is preserved in amber. And that amber is the 1980s in New York City in particular. He is, A, incredibly provincial, incredibly so. B, he comes from this world where corruption touched so many aspects of the political system, the real estate industry that his family business was in, aspects of the news business. And he, this is, you know, what shaped him and what he believed the world was and is like. And those moves are, you know, the handful of moves that he has. He doesn't change. It was amazing to me to interview people who knew him in the 1990s or 1980s and worked for him in private business. And they would describe him asking, you know, one of them, what do you think of that person? And that was one of his tricks as president, was, you know, to ask, you know, what do you think of the chief of staff? And that was how aides could tell that he was beginning to sour on someone. And it was part of how he would bond people to him. You know, he must not really be talking about me. You know, he's just talking about them. And so these, you know, he has these handful of moves. And some of them can be plain in front of you. Some of them are not. He's not, and I write about this, he's not strategic. He does not, there's no, you know, there's
greater
no,
there,
right, there's no 3D chess game going on. But he is, he is calculating in the moment. And he is often playing some game with rules that only make sense to him. And it is moment to moment. But he is more calculating than people realize, I think.
You know, we often look at him as this thing that doesn't make sense, but there are some seminal events that do make sense, and I've written them down. Number one, ward bosses who control absolutely, as they did in the New York machine. Political contributions meet a quid pro quo. Repeatedly, yep. He saw that money made yep. things go away yep. ever since he was a young man. And if you fight it long enough, you will win, beginning with Roy Cohn.
Those are also moves that he continued to use throughout the presidency. I mean, part of what I try to show in this book, and I'll get to the specifics you mentioned, but was how much of the presidency was foretold by the past and how much he exported all of this and these behaviors to Washington and then to the Republican Party. Look, it's not as if Washington is the purest of places, right? I mean, we're not talking about a place where political contributions, who knew that that's going to, you know, that people think that could open doors. He's incredibly overt about it, though, and he will, you know, he will openly say things like this. So for instance, I write in the book about him just sort of openly telling me that he had, when Andrew Cuomo was the HUD secretary in the 1990s, and Mario Cuomo, the former governor to whom Donald Trump had contributed a lot of money over the years, was then at the law firm Wilkie, Farr & Gallagher, and Trump wasn't getting what he wanted out of HUD. So he tried to get Mario to intervene and arrange for some conversation with Andrew, and Mario wouldn't do it. And then Trump tried to get Mario fired through the firm. And Trump is just sort of openly telling me that, you know, there was nothing wrong with what I asked. And it's analogous to, you know, I would like you to do us a favor, though, to Zelensky in Ukraine. It's the same pattern of behavior over and over again. And in terms of Roy Cohn, Cohn existed to grind people down, and Donald Trump exists to grind people down, and he is very successful at it.
But also, people want to say autocracy and all these big terms. I get the feeling he doesn't see it that way. When Meade Esposito said something went away in New York, it went that way, and he wasn't the first boss to do that. So in his mind, if you're the boss, being the boss means things go the way you say they go, no matter what.
Correct. And he would talk about, Meade Esposito was the Brooklyn Democratic Party leader with whom Trump's family was close. His father, and he, as Trump correctly said to me, Meade ruled with an iron fist, and he meant that admiringly. Meade Esposito was incredibly corrupt, you know, but what he made judges, he made DAs, and what he said went. And I asked Trump in one of our interviews if he thought that being president was going to be like that. And he, it was interesting. He said, and I know that he did actually think that, because he would you know, wax on about Meade Esposito in 2017 to AIDS. But he actually said he thought Mitch McConnell would be that way, that he thought that he would get Congress in line for Trump. And what was bizarre about, or the Senate, and what was bizarre about that is that McConnell actually whipped the Senate for Trump over and over again to get Trump's priorities through. But because there were a few dissenters in Trump's mind, it just wasn't the same. And so to your point, he doesn't see it in terms of ideological through lines or theories of governance. It's just bossism.
And so when somebody says, I can't do that, he's like, of course you can.
Yeah, of course you can. Why can't you? And that was what happened with Mario Cuomo. Was Mario Cuomo said, I can't do this. And it was, what do you mean you can't do this? So
I wrote down, you know, when you look at these behaviors that go on over the years, I wrote down the lies, the self-delusion, and the bullying. As a mother of two boys, I'm like, we're not doing this. I want to talk about the lying, the power of repeating. If I say things enough times, people aren't going to check it. It goes into the record. Yep. It must be true. You have a great example in the book of where he describes an event completely erroneously, but nobody checks it. And he describes it as a seminal event in his life that he made up.
And the details were almost entirely wrong. Yes.
And the question becomes, it's a game that he plays, and he played it with you. If they catch you play dumb, wait for them to make a mistake, then focus on their mistake, not what you did. But the question becomes, is he lying, but hey, or does he believe it when he tells lies?
So it's a great question. It's a question I've been asked a lot, and I think the answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. There's no question that there are times that he is saying something that he knows is not true. And I'll give you a for instance. In one of our interviews, he was trashing Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who he picked. And he was saying, for me, there were two Mark Milleys. And he said, you know, when he suggested that we walk together to the church, and he was talking about Lafayette Square on June 1st, and I interrupted and I said, he suggested? I mean, it's preposterous. And he said, well, let's just say it's equal. And so, you know, which is also not true, but he clearly knows what he's saying is not true. I don't know if he believes what he, and I think the most salient question on this one is obviously the election and what he says. And I don't know, I can't say whether he believes what he's saying or not. I think that he most likely does at this point. I'm not sure it matters. One is more insidious than the other, but they're both very destabilizing.
Well, let's talk about that, because you did bring that up. And there's a section in the book where you talk about it. The staff all expects he's saying things that make it sound like he gets that he lost and he's got to go. On page 464, there's a meeting, and Jared sends some people ahead, and they say, why aren't you going? And he says, I'm the priest. I come at the end to read.
The priest comes later, yeah.
And so there's a meeting, and the whole point of the meeting is to essentially say, sir, this is over. Trump listened to Clark and Stepien paid a grim case, laying out a 5-10% chance of success if they pressed ahead. Trump didn't yell or scream. He listened and said, okay. Most people would have heard those odds and taken them as a sign to curb their expectations. Instead, Trump took it as an opening. I think it's more like 40 or 50%. How 5-10 to him becomes, it ain't dead.
It's a little like how he was basing, and this is in the book as well, you know, the number of a certain tax cut he wanted in the tax bill in 2017, he liked the way it sounded better. You know, it's so much of what he says is about how it sounds, and can he convince you of it, and can he convince himself of it. There was just no one telling him this, except for, well, that's not, actually, I shouldn't say that. Rudy Giuliani was telling him this. You know, there were other people who were telling him that, that he should keep fighting and that his lawyers were wrong. You know, one of the things that gets said a lot about him is there's just no one around him to tell him no. And that isn't true. There have always been people around him who will tell him no. It's just that he often won't listen. They get grinded down. He will only tolerate no in certain doses. And so when you create a world like that, you're going to say something like that.
Which is interesting, because he's the first person to look at the people telling him yes and to say, these people are crazy.
Sometimes. I mean, it's funny. What comes to mind when you say that, I mean, I write about how he talks about his own supporters in the book, and I assume that's what you're referencing.
Who he'd never take out to dinner.
I mean, these are not people he would hang out with, and there's, you know, multiple scenes in the book to that effect. But Giuliani is somebody who he sought out and listened to and belittled and demeaned, and this is how he treats people.
And it's funny, that leads into my next question, which Giuliani's high point with him is on a private plane where he yells that he made the bathroom smell. I want to talk about his temper, because it is not a small thing.
No.
And his brothers are exposed to it, wives are exposed to it, people around him are exposed to it. And when he becomes president, there's no one, whether it's other administration officials, and this is what really stood out to me, generals, men who have gone to war. And this is what he says. On page 310, they're trying to explain to him why you don't pull out of South Korea. Mm. And they've tried to put it in such a way to show the importance. And this is what he does. The generals were dopes and you're losers and you're babies, he told them, that he wouldn't go to war with any of them because his feet are flat. To illustrate the point.
He didn't say that part.
No, but that's why he didn't. He got out of it. To illustrate, they tried all of these different things to show him everything in place meant how fast they could understand what North Korea was doing and that the difference between 30 seconds and 6 minutes matters. And he says, that's nice. I really don't give a shit. And you start to wonder, they're military people. You follow the chain of command. This is the commander of chief, the commander of chiefs. But over and over, the way he treats cabinet secretaries, the way he treats other people, and this goes back to in his early life, why nobody says, with a few exceptions, I'm not having this.
So it's funny that you said that. It's a great question. One of the things that I've been saying somewhat regularly since the book came out is that other than Fred Trump, John Kelly was one of the first people to say no consistently to Donald Trump around him in a sort of a position of authority. Now, not the only. There were a couple of people working at the Trump Organization, one of whom is about to testify against the company, Alan Weisselberg, the CFO, who was seen as some form of adult supervision over Trump and was a tie to Fred Trump, his father. It's not reductive to make the point that Trump is a wealthy child of privilege who believed the world was going to be hardwired for him. And when you are raised that way and you know everything is set up to go your way and people who follow rules are losers and suckers, you force a lot of people away from you who might otherwise try to stand up to you. And there are some in there. I mean, you know, Richard Ravitch, who ran a state entity from which Trump was seeking a tax break for one of his projects, you know, was infuriated with how Trump was talking to him. Ravitch ultimately lost at the end of the day, but he did put up a fight. But Trump ultimately won.
I wanted to, and the word that came to me as I read about any number of people was learned helplessness. Hmm. That's what he inspired in people around him. But there were two people who stood out. Beth Sanner, who was his briefer,
yeah,
and Bob Barr, who was his last attorney general. And I wanted to read this because, of course, he's always looking for somebody to blame. And he would say to her, you're talking too much.
You talk too much, yeah.
And he was really harsh with women. Somebody's a horse face. Somebody's a this. Somebody's a that. And yet, she showed a certain amount of moxie with him, and he tried to blame her for the coronavirus,
yes,
that she hadn't made it clear.
All right, that she hadn't properly briefed him.
This is like a movie moment. The implication was that Sanner, his intelligence briefer, had downplayed the virus. Sanner had told Trump the virus was deadly among older people and the immunocompromised, and she confronted Trump, which nobody just about does, reminding him that she had told him there were ways in which it could be acute. I would have remembered if you said elderly, Trump replied curtly. Sandra reminded him she took notes of what she told him and that what she said was in them. She does not back down. Bob Barr does not back down. Most men, Paul Manafort, any number of people, he tries to dominate.
Yes.
But it doesn't work with Barr, and it doesn't work with Sanner. What is different about them?
So it's an interesting question. Sanner is described by everyone who knows her as extremely comfortable in her own skin, confident in what she's doing, and just, you know, not timid, and for whatever reason, not afraid to confront him, and I think realized that he actually dreads one-on-one interpersonal conflict. So, and confrontation. He's great at firing someone by tweet because then he can just walk away from it and not have to own any of it. But when someone, you know, there's a scene I write about where he's screaming bloody murder at Joe McGuire, who was his director of national intelligence up until mid-February of 2020. And everybody in the room is standing around, you know, looking at their shoes. The vice president, the national security advisor, they're all just averting their gazes, as people often do when he has these eruptions. And finally, they clear the room because this briefing is just not going anywhere. And Sanner walks up to the Resolute desk and says, "You know, Mr. President, you know, the intelligence community is not against you." I'm paraphrasing, so I don't have the book in front of me, but it was something like that. And he very quietly says, "I know." And so, and this is all after all this sort of performative anger. And so in her case, I think she just sort of recognized that there was a water's edge in terms of how far he was going to go with her. Barr is a different figure because Bill Barr comes from New York, which I think actually gets missed a lot. Also a son of privilege, but whose father was a teacher at the Dalton School, but who, you know, was a conservative very young, and who writes in his own book about how he was handing out flyers for Barry Goldwater at age 12 or 14 in Manhattan, which was not exactly ripe for the picking. And, you know, he has a certain belief that things are, or at least approaches things with a certain belief that, you know, that he's right and that he's going to stand his ground. He really did push back on Trump. I mean, there were plenty of things that he did that were deeply controversial, and a bunch of them have come out since he left. He also was the only person to go out and say publicly, there is no widespread voter fraud in December of 2020. And that was not cost-free, and that was not risk-free, because Trump lost it when that happened. But Barr spent a fair amount of time pushing back on him, and Barr, you know, I write about the Oval Office moment on June 1st, 2020, when Lafayette Square happens, and it's Mark Milley, Bill Barr, and Mark Esper, the defense secretary. And Esper and Milley were really afraid that Trump was going to give an order to deploy active duty troops to stop the protests that were in response to George Floyd's murder. And Barr was not really worried because Barr had seen this before with Trump. Barr had spent much more time with Trump than the other two had. And he realized, and this is similar to Sanner, I think, to your question, because she had seen him he was not somebody who took a daily brief, even though it's the president's daily brief, but he would take it a couple times a week. And she had enough exposure to him to sort of figure out how to finesse and what to do. And Barr was similar. But after November 3rd, 2020, all bets were off on that.
There's a great moment that you report where he's the only person in the middle of the election craziness who says to Trump, "You are fucking this up. Yeah. You've wasted 5 weeks. This is what you should have been doing, and it's too late."
Right.
And nobody else will say, "You tactically didn't do this well."
Right. And I mean, you know, there are people who will object to the idea of the attorney general playing political counselor, but he did say to Trump, he said, "People are tired." There's a small person in here, so I'll use polite language. "People are tired of the effing drama." And, you know, and that was definitely true, of Trump's own base. But it was rare that somebody was willing to say that because most people tried to modify the world around Trump. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the book Harold and the Purple Crayon. I've been talking about this since 2017. And it actually prompted the brother of the actual Herald to send me an email recently, which was amazing. But Trump basically is, you know, he's got his purple crayon and he's creating his city, and it's just that the purple crayon is not drawing buildings and sky. It's drawing like
the presidency,
like a prison, and like, you know, places that he wants his enemies to go. And that he really spends as much time as he can trying to bend people and things to his will. And Barr was one of the few people to try to resist that.
That leads to my next question, which is Trump smart? And I ask because, you know, there are lots of different, there's a difference between do you have the capacity, some people don't, or is this a choice? And you write in the book, when he's confronted with things that he doesn't know, those who didn't know Trump well and who sat through that meeting, the one where the generals are trying to bring things to him, it ends with Rex Tillerson saying he's an effing moron, who sat through the meeting in the tank with him failed to consider something that people who had dealt with him over the years had experienced. Trump knew that he was being told something he didn't fully comprehend, and instead of acknowledging that, he shouted down the teachers. It is a sign of intelligence and humility and growth to say, I don't know. And he's been in plenty of school situations. He's been in plenty of other situations. And that's why I ask, is he smart? Does he choose to not do it, or is he incapable of doing it?
It's a really good question, and it's a bit of a hard one to answer. He doesn't read. He watches more television than anyone in this room can fathom. He had three televisions in his bedroom in the White House residence. He had two in the bedroom and one in the bathroom. He is incurious. He is insecure about his intellect, which is part of why he spends so much time telling everyone how smart he is. He is shrewd. That is what I would say. He is not knowledgeable, and I write about this, about almost anything outside the construction industry, certain aspects of the real estate industry, movies, golf, sports, you know, some aspects of pop culture, wrestling. You know, he is not, for whatever reason, he is definitely not interested in learning what he, being told what he doesn't know. He often seems to struggle with what he doesn't know.
That sounds like a prison.
I mean, what I think it sounds like is a difficult place to find a president of the United States.
That was a mic drop. Who is he politically? And I ask because of the seminal person in his life who's his father, Fred. And there's a moment when somebody from the John Birch Society, which is very conservative, comes, and he's given money to a lot of Democrats because that's who's running New York, but he says, what you're about is who I really am. And I think for many people, the arc in life is you go away from your parents and then you come back towards them. Trump, it's harder to tell because he's been all over the board. And so people will say, well, here's how you're not a Republican. Here's how you're not a conservative. And yet when you look back to his father, you wonder, I mean, they had to tell him to put some other pictures on the desk. Fred was the only picture on the desk. If that is his North Star, is he honestly a Republican and a very conservative man?
It's a really interesting question, and it's funny that you asked, because I got asked a related question at an event last night, which was, you know, if Trump had been a Democrat, because he had been a Democrat at one point, he's been all over the place, would he have, would the people in the elites in Manhattan have been saying something different about his presidency? Mm. That was the question. And my answer was, you know, the short version was yes, had he been a Democrat, because, and that's something that actually Chuck Schumer was terrified about when he was the minority leader and Trump was elected. Schumer was terrified that Trump was going to do an infrastructure deal and that he was actually going to pivot to the center and that he'd be successful at it because of the nature of the populism that he was appealing to. Trump never obviously made that tack to the center. So short answer is yes. The real answer, I think, is that he was never going to be a Democrat. So, you know, that's a way of answering your question, which is that, you know, it's not so much that I think that he didn't ideologically agree with a lot of the Republican Party at various points, but and he certainly liked tax cuts, and I think he liked aspects of Reagan's presidency appealed to him, but his main through line is admiring, quote-unquote, law and order. And so violence informs so much of what he thinks makes a strong leader or what forms strength, and it's that then informs what makes a good leader and a good boss. And so I think just because Republicans, for as long as he has been of age, you know, in the Nixon era, have been focused on law and order, I think that he was always going to gravitate toward being a Republican.
So his father, Fred, has an interesting history with race. The son of a German immigrant himself who marches with the Ku Klux Klan as a young man, who was brought up twice by government officials on excluding blacks from his buildings. But there's been a lot, of course, around Trump himself in terms of race and in terms of anti-Semitism. He's all over the board. And there are moments in the book, you know, he's dating a black woman and or a biracial woman, and he meets her parents. Her father's white, her mother's black, and he goes, "You get your intelligence from your father and your looks from your mother."
Other way around. Yeah, yes. He says you get your beauty from your mom and your brains from your dad,
right.
The white side.
And he will say these things, or, you know, he meets a black man who's running to be the Attorney General of Kentucky.
Okay.
And says, "Well, you know what I did with ASAP Rocky, right? Because he's black and he will want to know what's going on with the rapper case." Or he just says these things, and sometimes you think it's Archie Bunker meets Rodney Dangerfield. He's just trapped in time, and he can't move forward. But then, obviously, there are other parts of him that seems to recognize that his base, racism and anti-Semitism, is very important.
Oh, yeah.
We cannot give up Confederate monuments. We cannot change on law and order. We cannot do any number of things. And so how nuts it is when he's talking to people. There's a moment in the book where he's sitting around with his Jewish son-in-law and some other people.
At the end of the campaign. Yeah.
Right. And on one flight, his attention turned to the small group keeping him company, Kushner, Stephen Miller, and Jason Miller. "Who would have thought that my top guys are Jews?" Trump said. His son-in-law is a Jew. His grandchildren are Jews. And his daughter's a Jew. This after months of Trump telling Jason Miller that he had a sweet, understanding Jewish wife, except Miller's wife was not a Jew, and neither was he. He told Trump he was not, in fact, Jewish. "Wow," Trump said, appearing surprised, "so only your wife is." So that's the Archie Bunker, Rodney Dangerfield side. But then when you look politically, he taps into his base and knows that the racism and the anti-Semitism, and it's hard to tell, is he anti-Semitic and racist, or he just knows they brought me to the dance and I gotta stay?
I think at a certain point, when someone has been saying things like this as long as he has, you stop assuming that it's just to make a certain appeal. I think there's no question that he sees the value in it. You know, this incident with his biracial girlfriend, Kara Young, was in the late 1990s. You know, he appeared on a panel with Spike Lee in the late 1980s. And said something like, I'm paraphrasing, but it was like, I think his exact words were, "a well-educated black," because everything he says is the blacks, the Jews, you know, has an advantage over, he was talking about affirmative action policies, and he was being critical of them, and so essentially saying that he would prefer to come back as a well-educated black. That was and Spike Lee was sort of aghast and was trying to even grapple with this. And so racial paranoia has been rampant in New York City, where I grew up, for as long as I can remember. It was rampant when Trump was coming up as a young man, and he clearly incorporated it into his political personality. But when you add up Justice Department lawsuit against his company, the things that he has been saying about different racial groups for a very long time, the things he said as president, you know, gleefully referring to COVID as the China virus, a recent social media post about Mitch McConnell's wife, who I think he kept calling Coco Chow. I mean, it's like, at a certain point, it becomes, I feel like we've moved past the, but he could have meant something else, or he's doing this for effect. I mean, one of the things that I write about in the book is, to your point about it playing with his base, but also what he's comfortable with personally. There was a huge issue in the 2016 campaign where he would not disavow David Duke. And that's actually, it relates to a conversation that I began the book with, that I had with him. But at another point in the book, Chris Christie, who had just endorsed Trump, is urged by other Republicans to plead with Trump to reject David Duke's endorsement. And this is early. This is after New Hampshire. It's early in 2016 when Trump was pretty clearly on course to be the nominee, but people were still hoping to stop him. And so Christie calls Trump and suggests that basically do what Reagan did about the John Birchers, you know, and they may be with me, but I'm not with them. And Trump said, you know, he will reject it, but we don't have to do it right away. Quote, "a lot of those people vote." And, you know, at a certain point, it just becomes, I don't know what's in his heart. I'm not sure it matters. I mean, the things he is saying are incredibly incendiary.
Have you lost your ability to be shocked? In the last matter of days, he had a rally in which he made fun of using the N-word, which most politicians would do everything to stay away from.
I mean, he has become, yeah, I mean, that was a moment. He has become in sort of the most reductive version of what we have seen over the years, right? In the last 18 months or so, and is more than winking and nodding at the QAnon conspiracy theorists. He's appealing to them openly, and that is a violent conspiracy theory. He is animating a group of people and playing with things that can have real consequences.
The book points out that there's some things to mull over, maybe be a little uncomfortable about. Two major things play in his presidency, and they come from Hillary Clinton, her campaign, not necessarily her. The Steele dossier grew out of research that was done through her campaign, and the Obama birtherism came from people who were looking to support her and undermine Obama. What are people to do with this information that in some ways she was the conduit of this into the ecosphere?
So I think that, I mean, we know from from trials related to the Steele dossier that, or actually, I don't even think it was the Steele dossier. I think that it was the server issue. It was another potential thing that her campaign was looking at. Her campaign manager testified that she was aware of it. That one, I think, you know, her campaign at the end of 2016 was incredibly focused on Russia and Trump and Russia, and was frantically trying to get the press to focus on it in a different way. And I think that was a part of it. And I think that they went down. Look, government officials have said definitively, that Russia was behind the hacks and Russia was engaged in a number of efforts to interfere in the 2016 election. So you put that with the goal of helping Trump and hurting her. Put that aside. Her campaign also went down some rabbit holes as they were trying to draw attention to that. You know, the Steele dossier piece, the research on that actually, if I'm remembering correctly, began actually with some Republicans and then was taken over by a lawyer, the firm of a lawyer for her campaign. And so these things all have some weird connection.
Cross DNA.
Yeah. The birtherism effort by some of her supporters, it was not, you know, I've never seen any evidence that it had anything specifically to do with her campaign. In 2008, I put in a different bucket. But it is both, the common thread is both involve, I want to be careful how I answer this because they're not at all the same thing. Lying about the legitimacy of the first black president and you know, first potential black Democratic nominee is not the same as the efforts around what was happening with Russia, because it was pretty clear that a bunch of email hacks were happening, right? And so there were things that were going on. But there were efforts to look for a hidden hand that wasn't in every single thing they were looking at in 2016. And the birtherism lie was another sort of hidden hand effort. What I guess it speaks to is just the pull that conspiracy theories have in our politics on corners of them. And you know, that is something that Trump has obviously used to great effect, as I mentioned about QAnon. But that's what I make of it. I don't think they're the same thing.
There are many batshit scenes in the book, but the one that really stopped me is January 6th, and he's in the residence, and he's watching TV, and he says, maybe they should hang Mike Pence. That seemed to be a line that was different than any other line.
So he was actually in the dining room off the Oval Office. And Cassidy Hutchinson, who is a former advisor to Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, testified about this. You know, I think Trump has said he didn't say it, but there is so much around what happened with Mike Pence that I think it's almost as if the impact of it has gotten dulled, or our senses have gotten dulled in response to it, because it was so unimaginable. He was certainly not moving to stop anything, which we have heard testimony about over and over and over. I have a line in the book about how some of Pence's aides began to see Pence as a political prisoner who Trump was trying to break in the lead up to January 6th. And they weren't exaggerating. And then I have a scene in the book where Mark Short, Pence's chief of staff, on January 5th, summons the lead Secret Service agent for Pence to his office in the West Wing. And Trump had been becoming more aggressive against a number of elected officials at that point. And, you know, they knew this rally was coming the next day, and Mark Short, the chief of staff, informs Tim Giebels, the lead Secret Service agent, that Trump is going to turn on Pence publicly, and they're going to have a security risk because of it, or could have a security risk because of it. And it's just a breathtaking thing. I mean, there were, to your question about what can shock, when I heard that, I was quite taken aback, because you have the chief of staff to the vice president warning that the president is going to pose a security risk to the vice president. And it was the only security risk that Mark Short had ever flagged in his 2 years as chief of staff for the Secret Service. Now, there's nothing, the Secret Service doesn't do anything without a specific threat. That's just how they are, how they operate. But I thought it was a pretty remarkable moment on a couple of levels, one of which is it was so clear to a number of people in that White House at that point that Trump's behavior risked posing a serious problem on January 6th, and yet things marched on.
Please get ready, because it's time for you to be able to ask a few questions. This is my last one. You know, people think, have the idea that being a reporter for the New York Times and covering a beat like this is so much fun and so much glamour.
You too can sweat on stage with us.
What has it been? I mean, I know the book tour has been exhausting. The last few years have been exhausting. I read a profile in which you said, I honestly think until he passes, we are tied together. And it's a lot. Something similar.
Something like that.
I'm paraphrasing. It's a lot of work all the time. And I just wondered what it was like for you to be in this moment in history and on this beat.
I think what it was, so what I think I said was that as long as he's a story, I'm going to be sort of connected in some way as long as I'm in journalism. And I don't know that I'm turning 50 next year. He's 76. Like, I don't know what these tracks look like. But look, it is a privilege to do what we do. Like, no, we are not curing cancer. We are not, I'm not Doctors Without Borders, neither are you. We're not, but I do think what we do is very important. And I feel like it has been an honor to be in the position I've been in, and I felt an obligation to do it. And it was not always an easy job, and it was not easy on my family. I feel very honored to have been able to do this. And I have not done it perfectly, but I have done the best I can. So
I can't imagine anybody who would have done it better. So I think at this moment we'll have a few questions.
There's a school of thought that Trump never really wanted to be president, that he started his run for 16 just to improve his brand, and then he was as shocked as anybody that he became president. So my question to you is, do you think he really wanted to be president in 16? And then secondly, what do you think drove him post the 20 election to fail to leave the political scene and, continue to conduct rallies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
I asked somebody very close to him in April of 2016, does he really want to be president, or does he just want to win? And the person paused and said, that's a really good question, which I took as my answer. I have a slightly different take on it. I don't think that he ran to improve his brand. I think he ran because he was bored and is interested in attention. And I think the answer is the same as to why he wouldn't leave the political stage in 2020. And because he is, always branching off into new products, and the Republican Party became a new product, and he has enormous sway over it, and he was not going to walk away from that, and enormous fundraising ability, and he was not going to walk away from that. So
I think it follows up from the last comment you made. Why does he hold so much control, sway over the political class of the Republican Party?
He holds sway over the political class because he can really impact whether they get elected or not, and they like holding their seats. You know, he has huge sway with the voters in that party, and not every single voter, but the bulk of them. I think that there is... I think that his willingness in an era where politics is defined by who you hate and who hates you back, which really is our political system right now, and it is not just the Republican Party, he was able to brand himself as someone who can hate really well. And I think that, and fight, quote unquote, fight. And he talks differently than any politician they've ever seen, or that I've ever seen, or that you've ever seen. He is the biggest demagogue we have ever seen in this country. And there is power in that. And so I think that that is very simply why. But I mean, to me, the moment when I understood that something very different was going on than what people thought was the day after the Access Hollywood tape dropped in 2016. And I was at Trump Tower in the lobby seeing who came in and out. And I was following as Paul Ryan held an event in his district in Wisconsin. And he said something like, I'm going to address, you know, I don't think he said the elephant in the room, but it was like, I'm going to address, and it wasn't a room, it was an outdoor thing, but I'm going to address, you know, what we all know is going on. And he was critical of Trump, and he got booed. And, you know, a similar scene played out in New Hampshire, I believe, with Kelly Ayotte, who, you know, is no longer a senator. There is, all of politics now is anti. It's not about what you're for. And you can mass, at least, you know, with Trump it is, and a lot of his followers. And so that's why. And there are obviously deeper answers to that, but that's the top line.
Maggie, one of the quotes of this whole cycle that really strikes me is strangely from Mitch McConnell, who said that by historical standards, it was not a close election. And what I'm curious about is, was there a margin that they were working with that would allow a plausible challenge? Would there have been a number that would have neutered all of this and it, even he would have said, we lost?
No. Trump said the election that he won was rigged in 2016. So, you know, this is, no. This was the formula. This was always the formula.
Are you fearful for journalism and journalists?
Because of Trump, or what's the question? I'm always fearful for journalists.
Okay. Well, is there a greater risk now for people reporting?
So there's two great risks for journalism right now, and one is the fact that all of local news is under threat, which, frankly, to me, is the biggest risk for journalists. The biggest risk for journalism is that hedge funds are taking over newspapers, you know, and the devotion is to a profit margin, not to journalism. That worries me. Look, calling the press the enemy of the people is something that we have not seen from a president, you know, in certainly in modern history, at least not publicly. Nixon did all of it privately, and for the most part. And it, at minimum, gets used by autocrats globally to justify crackdowns on a free press, a point that our publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, made to Trump, to his face, in the Oval Office in 2019. You know, I go back to my, we're not curing cancer and we're not reporting on a war. There are a lot of risks to journalists, and they can take a number of forms. The biggest risk to journalists, in addition to the contracting of local news, is the distrust. And this is adding to that. You know, there's no question that we don't always help our own cause, but calling us the enemy of the people is pretty harmful. Now there are a number of Republicans who just won't talk to reporters, mainstream reporters, and that's very, very complicated.
What do you think is the source of Trump's rage?
Oh. That's an excellent question that I have not been asked. I mean, I think that there's probably a couple of things, but I think that I tend to think these things are kind of simple, and I think that he was the son of a father who Ivana Trump once described as brutal. And I think part of the appeal of Roy Cohn and why he tried to model everyone after Roy Cohn is Roy Cohn was his defender. And when people feel under threat, they look for a defender. I think that anger is also how he deals with all manner of anxieties. You know, and all you have to look back to is, why was he picking a fight over his crowd size on the first day of his presidency? Was it because he just wanted to have fun with the press, or was it because he was facing an enormous task that was hard? So,
first of all, thank you for being here. for the years of his presidency, we would wake up every morning to some new outrage and have this sort of, oh my God, moment every day. I can't believe that happened. I can't believe he said that. For you as a journalist, having been faced with the mendacity and the exaggeration and the misrepresentation and all of those behaviors that you described, how do you maintain your objectivity in the face of all that?
I'm going to give you an answer that's probably not going to satisfy you. So he's not the first journalist who has screamed at me. A politician who has screamed at me. He is not the first politician who has lied to me. He is not the first politician who has called me names. He is not the first politician who has attacked my colleagues. And he's not the first politician I've covered who exaggerated. He is the first politician I have ever covered who openly engaged in behavior like steering government resources to his business and paid no consequence for it, but or minimal consequence. You know, it is our job. I mean, it is our job to contextualize. It's not our jobs to just, you know, reprint what people say. And I think that, you know, a problem in terms of Trump's myth-making from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, if you go back and look at a lot of the coverage in New York and nationally from that period of time, it was just, you know, Donald Trump says as news. And no context, no fact-checking. No. And so I think that is vitally important, and I think especially around what he's saying about the elections, I think journalists are doing that. Whether voters are interested in that is a different issue, but it's our job. I mean, it's, you know, it, for the same reason, and again, I'm not saying that what we do is at all the same or as all dangerous, so I just don't want that to sound like a parallel, but no one asks people who are covering Afghanistan, you know, why aren't you screaming all the time? Because how would you be able to do your job if you were doing that? So I guess that's how.
Maggie Haberman, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.